Good morning, and thank you all very much for being here. There's a couple of little housekeeping items. Justice O'Connor has requested that there be no photographs taken after the first minute of her talk, and that there be no recording devices. Several months ago, I discussed with my friends who put on the Emily Couric Women's Leadership Award luncheon each year our mutual interest in inviting to Charlottesville the most influential woman in America, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. We decided that we would like to issue a joint invitation to Justice O'Connor to speak at the Miller Center and at the Emily Couric Awards luncheon on the same day. And knowing that Justice O'Connor receives many more invitations to speak than she could possibly accept, I decided to consult with our good friend, Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, to assist us in making the request to Justice O'Connor. For those of you who don't know, Judge Wilkinson is a graduate of Yale. His senior thesis, which was published in 1968 as Harry Byrd and the Changing Face of Virginia Politics, remains still, after 35 years, the definitive work of political history of that period. After Jay graduated from UVA Law School, he clerked for Supreme Court Justice Lewis F. Powell. He taught at the law school. He was editorial page editor of the Norfolk Virginian Pilot. And finally, President Reagan nominated him for a seat on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in 1984. From 1996 to 2003, Judge Wilkinson served as chief judge of that very important court. His questioning of counsel during oral argument is legendary for its rapier-like sharpness. I can testify to that because I've been on the receiving end of some of his questions. And his written opinions are among the most influential of any of the circuit courts in the country. National newspapers like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal speculate that he will finish his career as an Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Judge Wilkinson is a good citizen of Charlottesville and readily agreed to assist us in extending the invitation to Justice O'Connor. After he talked with Justice O'Connor, she very kindly accepted our invitations. So we're very grateful to Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, both for his friendship and for his assistance. To introduce his speaker, I'm pleased to welcome Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor and a privilege to introduce Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor to you this morning. As you might imagine, her resume and biography are most impressive, but that biographical information is something that you can find anywhere. There are just a few brief facts that I'd like to mention. Justice O'Connor learned to drive at age 7. And she could fire rifles and ride horses well by the time she turned 8. She had a bobcat for a pet. It took her only 2 years to finish law school. And she was confirmed by the U.S. Senate for her present post by the razor-thin margin of 99 to nothing. So you can imagine how that makes the rest of us feel. I learned to drive at 15. Took me well over 3 years to get through law school. I don't even want to mention what my confirmation vote was. And I had a gerbil, not a bobcat or a pet. Suffice it to say, I was a bit intimidated when preparing this introduction. It is, of course, a special pleasure to welcome Justice O'Connor to Virginia. She sat on the Supreme Court with one of the greatest Virginians, Justice Lewis F. Powell. And Justice Powell would take a special pleasure in these proceedings today. For the first part of his tenure on the Supreme Court, Justice Potter Stewart was Justice Powell's dearest friend. When Justice Stewart retired, Justice Powell was a bit forlorn and felt that his good company would be irreplaceable. Then several years later, Justice Powell told me that he had found a new best friend on the court, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. The only problem, he said, was that she wouldn't let him pull out a chair or open the door for her. Well, they had wonderful years of service together, and the nicest thing was that the O'Connors and the Powells were close as couples also. I think that may have been some small part because John O'Connor and Lewis Powell are both such terrific dancers. Justice O'Connor, like Justice Powell before her, is often referred to as the swing vote on the court. And I remember that Justice Powell heartily disliked that description. It implied, he said, that he was somehow swaying or flapping in the breeze. And that was about as wrong a description of Justice Powell as anyone could imagine. Justices play many different roles on the court with distinction, but I can tell you that it takes courage and tenacity and self-knowledge to chart a distinctive and independent course. And that is what both Justice Powell and Justice O'Connor have done during their tenures, and it has not been easy because it involves disappointing some of the people all of the time. I think many Americans are saddened today by the rancor and divisiveness in our public life, and that means that we as a country have all the more need for public figures like Justice O'Connor, because she reminds us of what we have in common as a nation, not what drives us apart. She transcends partisanship, and she appeals to the most generous instincts within us. She understands that there are patriots of all beliefs, and she understands further that it is possible to command enormous respect without heating up one's rhetoric or raising one's voice. Those of us who serve in the federal judiciary are mighty, mighty proud of her. I have the privilege of serving on the Judicial Outreach Committee of the American Society of International Law, of which Justice O'Connor is the chair. All of the judges on that committee admire the fair and even-handed and considerate manner in which she directs proceedings. Now, of course, she votes to reverse us all from time to time. But you know what? We admire her on those days too. I cannot begin to express to you how pleased and proud we are to have Justice O'Connor in our community and how much we appreciate her gifts to the law and to our country.
I think that's certainly the nicest introduction I've ever had or that I've ever heard. And I'm overwhelmed. And Chief Judge Wilkinson is just a judge in our federal court system of enormous respect by all of us, and certainly by me. And I thank you for that wonderful, wonderful introduction. The Miller Center is, I believe, unique in the country. The director is not able to give me another example around the country, of an institution quite like this, where a group of people come frequently, as often as once a week, to hear people speak on a wide range of topics and engage in discussion with them about it. That's quite remarkable. And it's the kind of thing that I guess the founder of this great University of Virginia would have thought was pretty good. I don't know if he would have wanted to see women at the podium, but I think the rest of it would have been of interest. And it's a great pleasure to be here with you today. And in thinking about what to speak about today, I thought about the issues and the conflicts between the executive branch of government and the judicial branch, which we're seeing in the country right now. Indeed, we have some enormously challenging cases at the Supreme Court. And as I considered the thoughts I wanted to share with you, I couldn't help but think of one particular historic figure of note, important to our court, William Howard Taft. A story is told that Mr. Taft once found himself stranded at a small country railroad station, informed that the express train would stop only for a large group of passengers. Taft wired the conductor, "Stop at Hicksville, large party waiting to catch train." When the train stopped, Taft boarded alone. He then turned to the confused conductor. "You can go on ahead," he declared. "I am the large party." Well, we laugh at that story because we remember that Mr. Taft, at his heaviest, tipped the scales at over 300 pounds. But as the 27th President of the United States and as the 10th Chief Justice of the United States, he also was the only person ever to have tipped the scales by holding both of those incredibly large offices. Experiencing firsthand the large responsibility of heading two of the most significant institutions in the free world, his time in those two roles put him on two different sides of the same constitutional coin. Indeed, our remarkable Constitution recognizes the individual largeness of these governmental bodies while acknowledging that their relative strengths will at times coexist, at times collide, and nearly always manage to carry out the will of the majority while safeguarding the rights of the minority. I want to spend time today to reflect on some moments in our history in which these two large institutions, the Chief Executive and the Supreme Court, with large constitutional obligations, have intersected, overlapped, and at times clashed. A look at the dynamic between the two speaks volumes about the genius of our Constitution. First, Jefferson and Marshall. To find an example of the judiciary and the presidency surviving the collision of two larger-than-life personalities, we don't have to travel very far in the early days of our republic. Distant cousins, John Marshall and Thomas Jefferson, were anything but the kissing kind. Indeed, their relationship was privately nasty and publicly only slightly better. Their exchanges, well documented but not well-mannered, planted the seeds for an all-out war on the proper role of the judiciary vis-a-vis the other branches of government. It set the trajectory of constitutional law as we know it today. Jefferson almost was not our third president, coming to the post only after the House of Representatives broke an electoral tie vote in his race with Aaron Burr. John Marshall almost was not our fourth Chief Justice, receiving the nomination from John Adams only after the first choice, John Jay, declined reappointment. But once fate brought them to their respective positions of authority, Jefferson and Marshall came to blows in ways that put even today's climate of political acrimony to shame. Early in his administration, Jefferson attempted to have Marshall impeached. He accused him of irregular and censurable behavior. In Marshall's hands, Jefferson said, the law is nothing more than an ambiguous text to be explained by his sophistry into any meaning which may subserve his personal malice. He spoke vehemently of his bitter disappointment in his own appointees to the Supreme Court, calling them lazy and weak for not standing up against the crafty Chief Judge Marshall. In turn, Marshall labeled Jefferson totally unfit for the presidency. Jefferson called a Chief Justice a man of lax lounging manners and profound hypocrisy. Now, over time, these two actors played out a rather hateful drama, rooted in personal animus and fundamental disagreement as to the proper role of government and the appropriate balance between the judicial and executive branches. History teaches us that it was Marshall's decision in Marbury versus Madison, a case that many might say might well have been captioned Marshall versus Jefferson, that permanently legitimated and strengthened the Supreme Court, and that gave the Chief Justice his least obvious but perhaps greatest victory over President Jefferson. In the watershed 1800 election, Marshall's Federalist Party lost control of the executive and the legislative branches to Jefferson's Republicans, and in an effort to retain some presence in government, decided to pack the judiciary on their way out the door. President Adams appointed Marshall, then the Secretary of State, as Chief Justice, and Congress passed a number of pieces of legislation to restructure the court system and provide the lame duck Senate and the outgoing president, John Adams, with many new positions to fill. Adams filled them, or thought he did, through a series of midnight appointments. But Jefferson fought back. When he took office, he refused to deliver the commissions of some of the appointees whose commissions had not been delivered. When Mr. Marbury, an appointed judge who did not receive his commission, sought a court order compelling the administration to deliver it, the case made its way to the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Marshall, to the surprise of many, denied the order that would have forced his nemesis to issue the judicial commissions. But the victory that he handed to Jefferson came with a silver lining for himself. The order was denied on the grounds that the part of the Judiciary Act that had given the Supreme Court the power to issue such orders was contrary to the Constitution. Writing for a unanimous court, Marshall declared that courts as well as other departments are bound by the Constitution, and more importantly, that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the Constitution means. In one fell swoop, Marshall gave up a small power that Congress had conferred upon the court and took in exchange an even larger overarching power to examine the ultimate constitutionality of all acts of Congress challenged in court. Despite the vehement disagreement of his cousin Thomas Jefferson, this bold assertion by John Marshall has survived as the final and official answer to this day. The lessons to be learned from the story of Jefferson and Marshall are too many to be recounted here. It's the story of a government that develops and grows and changes over time. It is the story of large institutions competing and accommodating in ways that both amaze and alarm us. Perhaps even more significantly, it's a story that begins a distinctively human thread that we will see woven throughout all the historic episodes I will mention today. The judiciary and the presidency are inhabited by real people with real emotions, real foibles, and a very real, if sometimes conflicting, commitment to doing what is right. Second, Lincoln and Taney. A second historic moment of interaction between the presidency and the judiciary stars President Abraham Lincoln and Chief Justice Roger Taney. To my knowledge, it represents the only time a sitting president has deliberately defied a direct court order. In the early days of the Civil War, the war between the states, as Justice Powell would have reminded me, the fragile American nation faced serious threats from within. The southern states had broken away, and European powers were poised to intervene, to divide the young nation permanently into Union and Confederacy. The war posed another sort of danger, a danger less obvious, perhaps, than columns of soldiers marching through the countryside, but far more insidious to a nation conceived in liberty. It was the danger that a government at war might use its extraordinary powers to stamp out political opposition. In April 1861, a trainload of Union soldiers passed through Baltimore en route to Washington, D.C. They were summoned to man the defensive fortifications around the capital city. They were greeted by an angry mob of Southern sympathizers and had to fight their way across Baltimore to another railroad station where their train to Washington waited. Later that night, local authorities who favored the South burned bridges and cut telegraph lines between Baltimore and Washington, claiming that Union soldiers might come back looking for revenge after the riot. Congress was out of session. President Lincoln found himself in a capital city with a rebel army to its south and a secession-minded mob to its north. Invoking his power as commander-in-chief, he authorized local military leaders to suspend the writ of habeas corpus along the railroad line from Washington all the way to Philadelphia. Essentially, this meant that Army personnel could arrest civilians without getting a warrant from a court or without probable cause to believe a crime had been committed by the person arrested, and without providing a speedy jury trial that the Constitution guarantees. Now, Mr. John Merryman, a member of the Maryland legislature, who had been recruiting rebel soldiers, was arrested by a Union general under this order of President Lincoln. Merryman was hauled off to Fort McHenry for incarceration. That's the fort in the Baltimore Harbor where our national anthem was penned, at least looking at the fort. This was when Supreme Court justices still rode the circuit, hopping onto their horses to serve as federal circuit judges around the country when court was not in session. When Merryman filed his request with his local circuit federal court judge, he went to none other than Chief Justice Roger Taney of Maryland. Taney was no friend of the Republican administration, and when he received Merryman's petition, he ordered the commander of Fort McHenry to bring Merryman to his court in Baltimore. Instead of complying, the commander sent back an aide with the message that the president had authorized the colonel to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. This, as you can imagine, incensed Chief Justice Taney. He wrote a fiery opinion, stating that only Congress had the power to suspend habeas corpus. The president's job, he said, was merely to see that the laws be, as the Constitution says, faithfully executed. President Lincoln did not publicly respond to Taney's opinion until Congress met a month later on July 4th. Taking aim at Taney's assertion, President Lincoln noted that in the Confederacy, the Constitution itself was being ignored, and that had he not acted when he did, Washington, D.C. would have fallen into Southern hands, and there would have been no Congress to act in response to the rebellion. He famously asked, "Are all the laws but one to go unexecuted, and the government itself go to pieces, lest that one be violated?" Merriman stayed in jail, and scholars still debate whether Lincoln had the authority to invoke the constitutional provision suspending habeas corpus during the early days of the war. This is not the place for me to wade into the muddy waters of that debate. It suffices to note that in March 1863, Congress itself gave Lincoln express legislative authority to suspend the writ, removing any constitutional obstacle to his detention of enemy Southerners. To his immense credit, Lincoln did not use this authority to trample on the civil liberties that the writ of habeas corpus was meant to protect. Recent historical studies have made clear that he never tried to suppress political dissent and always understood that a democracy grows stronger by allowing the people to voice their opposition to government, even in the midst of war. He appreciated that the strength of the Union lay not only in the force of arms, but in the liberties that were guaranteed by the open and the sometimes heated exchange of ideas. And he no doubt would have been pleased to know that soon after his assassination and the conclusion of the war, his predictions that habeas corpus would quickly be reinstated came to pass. In Lincoln's words, "What constitutes the bulwark of our own liberty and independence is not our frowning battlements, our bristling seacoasts, the guns of our war steamers, or the strength of our gallant and disciplined army, but rather the love of liberty and the preservation of the spirit which prizes liberty as the heritage of men in all lands, everywhere." In this way, what might otherwise be remembered as a clash between these two large historic figures can be seen as a moment of respect for the rule of law by both the President and the Chief Justice, seen from different perspectives. The constitutional debate sparked by Lincoln and Taney rages on even now, but we would do well to look beyond the conflict and to appreciate the character of both men behind the story. Their sincere, even if conflicting, examples of dedication to principle and to the people of a struggling nation loom large to this day. A third well-known account of the intersection between the large scopes of influence of the judiciary and the presidency is found in the story of President Franklin Roosevelt's court expansion plan. The current headcount of justices on the court is engraved neither in stone nor in the Constitution. Indeed, there have been so many fluctuations in the number of justices that the history of those changes has been put into a verse to help jog the memory. Congress decided at first to fix the number of justices at 6. Congress planned on a change to 5, but the 6 remained very much alive. 6 high judges, supreme as heaven, and Jefferson added a number 7. 7 high judges, all in a line. 2 more added, and that made 9. 9 high judges were sitting when Lincoln made them an even 10. 10 high judges, very sedate. When Congress got through, there were only 8. 8 high judges who wouldn't resign. President Grant brought the figure back to 9. Would a justice feel like a packed sardine if the number was raised to, say, 15? The last stanza of this little verse marks the so-called court-packing effort of Franklin Roosevelt. Citing the heavy workload of the court and the declining age of many of the court's then-sitting justices, President Roosevelt suggested an increase in ranks from 9 to 15. However, historians have long focused on what is widely believed to be the real reason for his plan. According to accepted wisdom, he was more than a little annoyed that the justices were giving a thumbs down to so much of his New Deal legislation. And he wasn't just imagining things. In the 140 years between 1790 and 1930, the court had overruled only 60 acts of Congress, barely half an act a year, as unconstitutional. But during President Roosevelt's first term, the court had found 12 acts unconstitutional, and some of those were the president's favorites. In fact, on the aptly named Black Monday, May 27, 1935, the court struck down three pieces of legislation all at once. At that pace, President Roosevelt feared the court would soon dismantle his New Deal completely. His clever proposal was to get Congress to pass a law that would let him appoint a new justice every time a justice turned 70. Coincidentally, six members of the court were over 70 at the time. A cartoon published at the time showed what people thought the president was after. It shows the nine then current justices on the bench, along with six new President Roosevelt lookalikes. Finally, Senator Burton K. Wheeler of Montana obtained a letter from then Chief Justice Hughes. As Senator Wheeler recalled, you could have heard a comma drop in the caucus room as I read the letter aloud. In it, Chief Justice Hughes struck down the arguments offered by the president and his supporters, detailing how the court was fully abreast of its work. It was not rejecting important cases to keep its dockets clean. His last argument was the clincher. An increase in the number of the justices of the Supreme Court, he said, would not promote the efficiency of the court. It is believed it would impair that efficiency so long as the court acts as a unit. There would be more judges to hear, more judges to confer, more judges to discuss, more judges to be convinced and to decide. The present number of justices is thought to be large enough so far as the prompt, adequate, and efficient conduct of the work of the court is concerned, said Chief Justice Hughes. President Roosevelt's court packing plan was dead, and so the court survived what many viewed as one of the greatest crises of its history. It emerged larger in influence, if not in numbers, and more keenly aware of its sometimes tenuous, but always interesting, relationship with the presidency. Truman and the Steel Seizure Case. Perhaps the most significant story to be told on this subject, at least in terms of legal precedent with which it gives us, is the one I save for last. It takes place in April 1952 during the Korean War, and it features President Harry S. Truman, a steelworkers' union, and Justice Robert Jackson, who you might be interested to know had as a law clerk at the time a bright young lawyer by the name of William H. Rehnquist. At this critical time in the war effort, the steel industry and the union had reached an impasse in their negotiations. A looming strike by more than 600,000 steelworkers threatened to cripple the production of weapons, and in Truman's eyes, endanger American troops serving in Korea. Ever sympathetic to the steelworkers, President Truman had worked for months to keep the strike at bay, and he turned to his advisors for counsel. The recommendation? To seize the steel mills, forcing the companies and labor to return to the bargaining table, and management to retract what Truman viewed as outrageous demands for regulatory approval of significant price per ton increases. The president took the advice he received, and just hours before the scheduled strike, in an impromptu press conference, President Truman looked into the camera and announced on national television that he would order his Secretary of Commerce, Charles Sawyer, to take over the steel mills and keep them running. The president's advisors, as it turned out, had not counted on the courts entering into this fray. Historical documents tell us that they counseled him that the odds were low that the judiciary would involve itself in such a hot-button issue, and that the short-lived seizure would serve its design purpose of nudging labor and management into more productive talks and have no wider ramifications. What resulted was something much larger, an act that would forever impact the American presidency, and a watershed Supreme Court decision defining the limits on the scope of presidential power. It began with United States District Judge David Pine, who, to the surprise of the administration and even the steel company's own lawyers, declared the seizure unconstitutional, saying there was utter and complete lack of authoritative support for a president's seizure of private businesses. The Circuit Court of Appeal entered a stay, and the U.S. Supreme Court heard expedited arguments. In its decision in Youngstown Sheet and Tube versus Sawyer, it echoed the district court's rebuke of the president. He had indeed exceeded his powers under the Constitution. Writing for the majority, Justice Hugo Black rejected the administration's argument that in a time of war, the president could exercise his emergency powers in so broad a fashion as to be almost boundless. But the most enduring opinion in the case was the concurring opinion written by Justice Jackson, an insightful exegesis on the issue of presidential powers that became the true legacy of Youngstown Sheet and Tube. According to recent writings on this historic case, President Truman, never one to keep his feelings masked, asked a top advisor to list on a single sheet of paper the reasons why the Supreme Court's decision was wrong. The president took the sheet with him to a dinner party hosted by Justice Black at his home, at which all of the justices were present as a sort of peace offering to the beleaguered President Truman. The first line of Truman's paper, we're now told, read as follows. The Supreme Court substituted its judgment for that of the president as to the seriousness of the cessation of production of steel at this time. Now, whether Truman ever actually delivered that message is unclear. It is reported, however, that at the end of that dinner, President Truman turned to Justice Black and said, I don't like your law, Hugo, but this is mighty good bourbon. When the founders crafted the masterful Constitution that survives to this day, could they have imagined the drama of those stories I've just told you today? Could they have anticipated the human dynamics and the battles of will that would pepper the centuries to come and change the course of history in such fascinating ways? Perhaps, but certainly at a minimum, they foresaw there would be times of crisis, real and perceived, international and domestic, personal and political, and that these times would inevitably put the president in the boundary-pushing role of defining his own powers and put the courts in the precarious role of reviewing the president's acts. They knew, because common sense dictates as much, that institutions that are large in power and large in their impact inevitably have run-ins that are large in scale and large in their ultimate consequences. But they also trusted that in times of trial, their balanced system of government would provide an even larger perspective. They knew that the people of their fledgling nation could be counted on to choose their leaders wisely, and that those chosen could be counted on to respect the roles set forth for them. As we face the trials of today, we can find hope in the dignity with which the presidency and the judiciary have emerged from even the rockiest episodes of the past. No doubt, when this same speech is given at the Miller Center 100 years from now, it will be remembered that the tasks before us were large, but I'm confident it will also be remembered that, like our forebears, we were strong enough to meet them. Thank you.
Before I ask John Jeffries, the Dean of the University of Virginia's Law School, to open the discussion with the first question, a couple of other matters I'd like to do. I'd like to recognize Mr. John O'Connor, Justice O'Connor's husband, who is seated here in the front. When asking questions, after I recognize you, please wait for either Courtney or Dina to come to you with a microphone so the people in the outer rooms can hear the questions. People who are seated in the outer rooms, the ushers will have little question cards, and if you would write a question that you would like to have asked on it, it'll be passed up to the front, and if time permits, we will ask Justice O'Connor to consider as many as we can. So, Dean Jeffries, would you ask the first question?
Thank you very much. I'm honored to have that opportunity. Justice O'Connor, you were identified by Jay Wilkinson as having been confirmed 99-0. And although that's a remarkable record, historically, a great many justices were not very controversial.
That's true.
Today.
Thankfully, today they are.
Yes, ma'am. And my question, I'm trying to avoid asking about any of the current pending cases on which you can't comment. My question is whether you would tell us whether that division and sense of contest and partisanship that has pervaded the political arena in its selection and approval of judges has also found its way into the inside of the Supreme Court.
It has not. It has not. We do have opinions, which you can read, we all do, where the rhetoric is pretty tough sometimes, and I wish it weren't that way, ever. But it hasn't carried the day in the relations between the justices at conference or in person, I'm glad to say. There have been times in the court's history when some of the justices did not get along. Not this era of concern, but previous times when perhaps appointment of justices would have been easier, but those appointed didn't get along. And I'm very grateful that I have not had to serve on the court and at the court during a time when there were internal dissensions of that kind.
Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and the distinguished historian of the American South, Ed Ayers, do you have a question?
I'm sure I do.
George, I owe you one for this. As someone who thinks about the American Civil War a lot, and I was obviously intrigued by the story of Lincoln and Taney about this, do you think that all the questions raised by the Civil War have been smoothed over? Even in your comments, you still had to pay obeisance to Justice Powell's terminology mm-hmm. for all this. Mm-hmm. Do you think there are still any buried questions from the era of the Civil War that we still wrestle with today?
I think probably so. That was clearly the most tragic, serious problem that ever confronted this country. I hope we'll never have anything that even approaches it again. It was tragic in every respect. I grew up in the Southwest, more concerned with bobcats and fences and trucks and so forth than with Civil War history. And it didn't mean much to me, to tell you the truth. Things east of the Mississippi to people in the West don't much matter. And I hate to tell you that, but it's true. It's true. On the other hand, people who live east of the Mississippi don't think the West much matters either. So there you are. But when I came back to Washington, D.C. and started living in the area, I'm not sure I can even define it, but all of a sudden, the Civil War experience was part of what surrounded me here. I visited Gettysburg for example, and some of the other sites, and around Washington, D.C. itself, I visited several sites of old forts that were built to protect the city. And I had an historian go with me and my law clerks to visit some of those. And it was so dramatic. General Jubal Early came up to, I guess it was Fort Stewart on the north side of town, close to what we call 16th Street today, and were attacking from that point, and there weren't enough soldiers to hold it. They had to call the civil servants from downtown to run up that hill and come man that little fort, and Lincoln himself was supposed to have come and stood up to get a better view and nearly got shot. I mean, these were dramatic things in the very community when all of a sudden I found myself living. And you could see the effects of the war, the tremendous influx of African Americans to Washington, D.C. And to this day, the African American population of the city is greater than the white population of the city, which has affected the political life of the city, and neither of the neighboring states want Washington, D.C. as part of them. And we're still looking at the problem of, I mean, every license plate from Washington, D.C. refers to taxation without representation. They don't have a representative in Congress with a vote on the floor. They have a representative who's elected in the district and who participates in committee meetings and decisions and votes, but not on the floor. And this rankles to this day. That's an outgrowth of all this. And it is everywhere today. No, it hasn't all been ironed out and smoothed. We see it in the country. Anything that tragic and that dramatic perhaps can't be erased for a much longer time than we've had so far.
Would you wait?
Yes, just a historical note. You said that the case with Taney and Lincoln was, to your mind, the only case where the president had refused the direction of the Supreme Court.
Deliberately. Well, and it isn't exactly true either, because there was President Jackson. There was the case that John Marshall also wrote dealing with the Indian rights in Oklahoma, the Cherokee Nation case. And the Supreme Court said, yes, the Indian tribes were entitled to those lands. And Jackson just said no. So I think that is another example of a president who absolutely disregarded Marshall's Cherokee Nation opinion to the great damage and detriment of the Cherokee tribe.
Yes, ma'am.
I was just wondering, when you mentioned what we all remember is Roosevelt's attempt to pack the court, excuse me, and Justice Hughes said that they could take care of their cases just fine, thank you. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, you all get so many more requests, don't you?
We do.
And I just wonder, and you can't take, anyway.
But we're taking fewer cases.
I was wondering if there was any movement now to increase the size of the court.
No, and indeed. Chief Justice Hughes was right. As long as we have to sit together en banc as a unit, if you add justices, it makes it harder, not easier. I mean, we'd do a lot better with three or five. We'd be more unanimous. But people don't want that. Nine's a good number, and we've had it a long time. And it would be unfortunate to try to make it some increased size. And we do get more petitions. When I went to the court in 1981, we had about 4,000 that year saying, please take my case. And we took about 160. This term, we have close to 8,000 petitions. And I don't think we'll have more than 85, 87 cases by the end of the day. So we're doing okay. As Chief Justice Hughes says, you don't have to increase the number, Mr. President.
One of the young people up here in the corner. We're happy to have a number of young women from the Village School of Charlottesville as our guest today.
I was wondering if you thought that it was harder for you to achieve your position because you were a woman.
Well, as a matter of fact, it was probably easier. I'll tell you why. The court had operated for 191 years without a female member, and people, even presidential candidates, had noticed that fact. And President Ronald Reagan was kind of looking around the country for votes, and he realized that half or more of the population were women. And it wouldn't hurt to give women some reason to vote for him. And he said, now if I'm elected president and if I get an opportunity, I'd like to put a qualified woman on the Supreme Court of the United States. Well, sure enough, he must have gotten enough votes from somewhere because he was elected president. And it wasn't long before Justice Potter Stewart stepped down, retired, and President Reagan had to come to grips with that campaign statement of his. And he kind of liked to ride horseback, and he kind of liked to mend fences at his little ranch and do those things that ranchers do. And so when he looked around for a woman, in the first place, there weren't a lot of Republican women judges in the country. He had a pretty short list. And if he could find a cowgirl on the list, that probably looked pretty good. So I think it helped me rather than hurt me to be a female and a cowgirl.
Dr. Turner.
I would like to ask the chair if I could share a story and the justice about Lewis Powell that occurred with me and showed his tremendous sympathy for the downtrodden. In 1952 in May, I was first year at UVA, and his oldest daughter, Josephine, invited me to May Day at St. Catherine's School. Well, it was a very nice weekend, and she even came in his brand new Mercury station wagon to drive me down to the Presbyterian Church on Capitol Square. And after that, she said, wouldn't you like to drive us home? Well, about three-fourths of the way home, I had other thoughts on my mind and ran a red stop sign and demolished his brand new station wagon and a very large brand new Buick. Well, I never made it to the Sunday dinner. I don't know where I went to hide, but about 3 or 4 days later, a letter arrived from Justice Powell to me, and I'm still looking for it, expressing his sympathy, offering to provide legal counsel, the most empathetic and sympathetic letter that I've ever received. I did have another date or two with Josephine, and my twin brother actually started dating her younger sister, Molly, so I guess the story ended well.
That's a great story, and it is a good example of the kindness and thoughtfulness of Lewis Powell. That's a great story.
Recently, it was reported in the local paper that our congressman, Virgil Goode, suggested that Congress should be able to overturn a Supreme Court decision. Would that ever be possible? And if so, how could that take place?
Well, yes, it is in this way. I think that the framers of the Constitution and our first president thought that Congress, as much as the president, and the courts had a role to play in determining constitutionality of legislation. And I think the early framers and our first president envisioned a more robust role than we see exercised today. But nonetheless, about a third of our cases involve interpreting laws passed by Congress. And if we decide that a law passed by Congress, let's say in 1970, means X, and if the present Congress says to itself, that's crazy, that couldn't be what we meant, we're going to change that. Congress can tomorrow rewrite the law and get around the Supreme Court decision, and they do it all the time. They do it all the time. So it's a dialogue. Now, suppose that Congress passes a law and it's challenged in court and it is determined ultimately by the courts that the law Congress passed is unconstitutional for some reason. Now what can they do? Well, sometimes they do pass legislation that tries to get around it some way. And to some extent they can. If the reason for constitutionality is because the law had a certain provision, and if they alter that provision, then you have a new law and a new question. So again, it's a sort of dialogue. They can't just pass a law that says the Supreme Court is wrong and we're right and goodbye. It won't work that way. But there are all kinds of things that can be done and that are done to avoid the consequences of a particular court determination. So it's more of a dialogue, really, than the end of the line.
You're often referred to as the swing vote of the Supreme Court, or the vote that ends up making a decision final. What happens in your mind, or how do you struggle with those sort of decisions, and what finally changes your mind, I guess, on a normal basis to do that sort of thing?
Well, I don't know what sort of thing you have in mind. I'm sorry.
I have an example. Okay. Usually, I think there was a case with Tennessee, the federal courthouse decided they...
Oh, the ADA case.
Exactly. How did you change your mind about that case?
I didn't change my mind. Or I voted what I thought.
How did you change the court's mind?
I mean, that's what I don't understand.
Well, how did
I decided it in a way that I thought was justified under existing doctrine as applied in this context. Okay? All right.
There's a question from one of the overflow rooms. Did you ever imagine that your Supreme Court would have to be involved in deciding the presidential election?
No.
To ask the closing question, I'd like to call on our good and esteemed friend, the former director of the Miller Center, the man who really built this institution, and today the director of the Miller Center Forum, Professor Ken Thompson.
You're familiar, Your Honor, I'm sure, with Lincoln's grave question. He said, it has long been a grave question whether any government, not too strong for the liberties of its people, can be strong enough to maintain its own existence in great emergencies. Is this question still true at home and abroad as we face the future?
Well, we're looking at some very grave questions today. Will we survive? Surely we will. Will we survive with all of our goodwill and good reputation intact? Perhaps not. Certainly we'll survive. It's a question of how well and what we will do in the future. And we hope we will have, as examples I tried to give you today, illustrate the capacity to address grave problems and to resolve them in ways that do enable us to go on.
Because Justice O'Connor and Mr. O'Connor have to go to the Emily Couric Awards luncheon directly from here, I'd like to ask if everybody would simply remain in place while we exit the room and continue our thanks of Justice O'Connor for a wonderful time.